seated. Good morning. The next case set for oral argument this morning is Edward Monin versus Estate of John Monin and John Monin Trust and a number of other defendants. Ron Parsons is here on behalf of the appellants. He'll be arguing, and Albert Stephen Fox is also present. And Brad Schreiber will be arguing on behalf of Appley Plaintiff. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Parsons, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You may proceed at this time, Mr. Parsons.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court and my friend at counsel's table. This case involves a fundamental equitable doctrine, that of latches. I've always liked cases that sound inequity because they're not just about a mechanical checklist of elements, but about an assessment of factors and the application of traditional and historical rules in order to arrive at what is a fair and just result. And it's not just about money, but about what ought to be and about what ought to be done based on the wisdom of experience developed over the centuries. In many ways, equity is the highest expression of both the art and the science of judging. And that's what brings my clients before this honorable court this morning. This case was brought by Edward Monin, who was one of the 15 sons of Joseph and Anna Monin, as a quiet title action. Which sounds inequity, the John Monin Trust, to which John Monin, the eldest son of Joseph and Anna, deeded the entire farm, brought a counterclaim to quiet title in its favor, with claims and affirmative defenses of latches and adverse possession. So the question is, under the law and principles of equity, who owns this farm? Is it the trust? Is it the estate of Joseph Monin, who died in 1969? Is it the estate of Anna Monin, who died in 1996, or is it a combination of all these entities? We respectfully contend that it's the John Monin Trust in which title should have been quieted in this case. The timeline is very simple. Joseph Monin died in 1969, leaving a farm to his wife, Anna, and his oldest son, John, but there was no will. That was his intention, that it go to his son. But he had 15 children, and under the 1969 laws of intestacy, a third went to Anna, and 15, or two-thirds, went to the 15 children. But, as an additional wrinkle, Joseph didn't own this entire farm at all. Much of it was owned independently or jointly with Aunt Anna and jointly with John. It depends on the parcel you're looking at. So that complicates things even further.
I'm going to get ahead of you, Mr. Parsons, and get to the division issue too soon, so yeah. Forgive me, but we're kind of there. It seems like the circuit court applied, as you say, some of the intestacy laws, but maybe not all of them, with respect to maybe the 2019-2020 deeds. There's also an argument that you've included that Anna and Joseph owned Parcel 3 as husband and wife, and you suggest that that means they owned 50% of that interest jointly, maybe with rights of survivorship. So is this, what do we do? Is this the right form? Is this the right case? Is the relief that you're requesting to go back at a minimum and apply the intestacy laws and recognize some of these more recent deeds? What do we do?
Only if this court rejects our two primary arguments, latches and adverse possession. There would be no need to go into the parcels at all if this court accepts our argument that latches should apply. And I did want to just correct our brief. I think there's actually two parcels. I incorrectly stated it in our brief. There are two parcels where Anna and Joseph owned it jointly, I believe, although I didn't. I wanted to correct that in our brief. But
maybe there was two. I'll look at that. Thank you.
So I have a question. Yeah. Maybe. Yes, sir. This is a little bit off as well, but I want to ask it. The other, we've got two siblings of Joseph that are really in this dispute. We've got another 13 siblings, or probably heirs at this point of 13 siblings. Are they out at this point, or what's your view of those other 13?
Yeah, well, the evidence may indicate, we don't know for sure, but that 12 of the 14 conveyed their interests in the 1980s. That was the best testimony we had. We don't have the best testimony because of latches.
But the real estate record doesn't necessarily show that. Recorder's office doesn't necessarily show us.
No, and the only expert presented in this case did not give an opinion as to who owned these properties at all, just who's on the title. And the only people on the title are Joseph Monin, who died in 69, Anna, who died in 1996, and John Monin, who ran the farm his entire life and died just a couple of years ago, 2018.
So it gets back to my question. Do you think we have any resolution of those other 13 siblings
at
this point?
Okay. No. They don't have an interest. If the court would hold that the estates of John and or Joseph and John and Anna are the title holders, I guess then they can fight it out in the estate, I guess would be how that would go.
With regard to what happened in the 80s and if there was this transfer, I know a large part of your argument on the latches is that Edward did have knowledge of an interest in the property. So our test, the legal test, refers to full knowledge, and I'm struggling with, and I don't think we've defined what is full knowledge. Is that something different than actual constructive? Is it a different concept? Does it include both? Can you speak to your thoughts?
This was a great case to have because I got to go through the history of latches, you know, from the time, even U.S. Supreme Court cases, England, and then all of this court's cases. And I think something happened in the 70s and 80s that kind of locked this court into a mechanical test for latches, like, did you meet this element? Okay, then it doesn't apply. Did you meet this element? It doesn't apply. When really, throughout history, this court's history, latches is really an assessment of all the factors. It's really factors, not elements. For example, you could wait a minimal amount of time, even less than the statute of limitations, but latches could apply because the prejudice is so unfair and so obvious. And by the same token, if the reason you can't prove full knowledge is because 40 years have passed and everyone is dead, that's a prototypical example of latches. So we didn't meet the full knowledge test in this case, but the reason you didn't meet it, I mean, if you say that, the reason you didn't meet it is because everyone's dead and it happened 40 years ago, latches is still an appropriate remedy. But I contend, and we contend, it was very clearly erroneous for the court to suggest that there was not full knowledge because Edward himself admitted, I mean, the testimony we have is back in the 80s, Leonard Andera, who died in 2012, wrote every single one of these siblings about this parcel and asked them to convey their interests, all of them, without exception. And 12 of the 14, and the 15th was John, Leonard Andera was John and Anna's attorney, apparently agreed to do it. That was Teresa, her testimony, the youngest Monin sibling. Only five of the siblings are left alive, and only two could testify at trial, Edward and Teresa. But both of them admitted in the 80s, we had knowledge. Everyone knew this. And lawyers were involved.
And so, latches is defense and equity. How much weight should we put on John's inaction to litigate the circumstances of the title?
John's inaction, or Edward's. John's inaction, our client's inaction.
Yes. And how is he prejudiced? He had probably the most knowledge. He's farming the parcels. He has unique knowledge of the parcels.
He had control. He ran the farm. He was the only one running the farm. He got the profits. He paid the taxes. He did everything. And everyone understood that he owned the farm. And that was the intention of the father. It's possible, but latches doesn't apply to him because he's the one who had possession. So it's their failure when they know that they have an interest and are told by lawyers and that John is claiming the entire property. It's their failure that is held against them when you try to quiet title.
But in the context, as you say, of this broader common law equitable rule of latches, we do at some point look at the prejudice that would be attendant to the party who's seeking to invoke latches, and maybe that's the question that Justice Kern is driving at. It's my own. I mean, how is it that someone who had preeminent control over this farm for so many decades, didn't take action to consolidate the ownership he now claims.
Yeah, he's prejudiced because he had control, he had action, he actually deeded it to a trust, and the other siblings acquiesced in all of that, waited until everyone is dead, and then file an action to quiet title after it's been conveyed to the trust. So we have no evidence. This was a three-hour trial that was over before lunch. When they decide to challenge title, and title is in John's, and he has it, it's in the trust. Title is in the trust of the entire property on paper, and it was deeded entirely by Anna to John in 1990. They sat aside for 40 decades and didn't bring any challenge. He had no reason to challenge anything because he had ownership.
You said all of the other siblings acquiesced in that, the deed. How did Edward acquiesce in the deed?
He testified that he actually was one of the ones that apparently conveyed it or was willing to convey his interest in the 1980s. And then in the 1990s, everyone, or in 1990, when Anna deeded it to Edward, the entire property, no one challenged that at all. And then Edward actually rented the property, paid rent to John for like 16 years to farm this land, rented it. And then when things went wrong and Edward started to get into a lot of trouble, John terminated the lease and rented it to neighbors. So Edward acquiesced in John's claim.
There is some reference, I think, in the findings or the court's memo that the rent was paid back to him. What's your assessment of that?
I didn't get a good assessment of that at all from reading the record. I'm sorry, Your Honor. That didn't strike me at all that was part of it, but he paid rent.
I want to get to adverse possession. Can I ask one last question, though, before we do that? The court found specifically that Anna deeded her interest in the property to John. Of course, that's the 1990 deed. And then the court continued, as well as some of the siblings, Ed did not sign the deed. So the finding, Anna deeded her interest in the property to John as well as some of the siblings, that last part, as well as some of the siblings, does that refer to, I believe it was David and Sharon that conveyed in 2019 and 20, or do you think that's a reference to someone, the siblings conveying in the 80s? I know your brief contains some of those references that, hey, we think they did it. But I don't know if that finding helps you or not.
Yeah, it could be both, because I do know that after the fact, there are, as in a brief, there are at least two or three that have re-deeded or reconveyed once this dispute started to happen, their interests.
Can I ask you a question about adverse possession?
The
difference that I'm zeroing in on is 15315, of course, the pay tax statute for 10 years, that theory, and then the more traditional 15312 theory. There's a textual difference, and I don't know if it matters at all. I didn't see it in the brief, so maybe it's just not a good argument. And 15312 has the is a very short formulation, but it speaks about actual and continued occupation of the premises under a claim of title. It says exclusive of any other right. The 15315 doesn't say exclusive of any other right.
Right.
I don't know if that means it isn't a component or it is a component, but our cases, as you noted in our Healy case, we may have a question about whether the 15315 theory contains traditional elements, hostility, exclusivity, or whether it's just a straight statutory test. You're in it, you're in possession of it. You have a good faith color of title, and you pay taxes for 10 years, and that's it. What's your view?
I think they are different, but good faith might encompass some of the same elements. You have to possess it in good faith, and I think clearly that happened. I mean, no one challenged that this was John's farm for 40 years until after he was dead. I mean, that's really the reality of this. And the court was focused, the lower court was focused on ouster, and we contend that the court was legally incorrect in its application of ouster. Any claim of possession by a co-tenant constitutes ouster. Under this court's decisions in Teason versus Qualley, which is a 1909 decision, no proposition is more fully settled than that the possession of a co-tenant is adverse when he claims the whole estate. That's 1919, this court, and even Iverson talks about the more recent case that the court talks about constructive ouster, and the Tiffany treatise that we've cited, and all the other treatises we've cited. So there was a constructive ouster here. It's not, do you have a shotgun and you ran him off the property? That's not ouster. Ouster can be a claim of exclusive right. You say, this is my farm, and I run it, and you don't have an interest. You're not here.
Counsel, and your point is well taken. I also wondered about the fact that this farm consists of five different parcels, and with some of those parcels, there was not an equal right to possession, even if there was one, with respect to John and Edward. So do you see that affecting whether ouster would apply in the traditional sense?
Yeah, it would be almost impossible to untangle at this point, yes. I mean, how do you oust them from something they have no right to at all? Because Anna and John, I mean, John bought some of this property himself, brought some of it jointly with John and Anna, or Joe and Anna. And so how do you untangle that? That's why latches applies, because you can't come back 50 years later and try to do this. Thank you,
Mr. Parsons. Mr. Shriver, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I think what I want to do is I want to start here. Our position is there can't be any adverse possession in this case, and there can't be any latches in this case. Because at the time that Joseph Monum died, he died without a will. We all know that. At that time he died, what he owned was vested in his heirs. One-third went to Anna, two-thirds went to his siblings. They automatically became owners or had an interest in that property. And the only way they lose their interest in that property is if they deed it away. There wasn't a probate. The probates are pending right now. Anna's probate is pending right now, and so is Joseph's. So depending upon the outcome of this matter, those matters will be probated, and then if this court were to affirm, then the ownership of the property, the interest, will be determined at that time. Obviously, there have been some siblings who have passed away since then, and so there will have to be a determination as to who the heirs are. I believe it'll be in the probate actions. I think it has to be.
There is a statute, and I don't know, I didn't see it in the briefs. Maybe it was there. Forgive me if it was there, but there's a statute within the quiet title chapter, 2141.18, that provides that the circuit court has jurisdiction in quiet title actions to determine who are the heirs at law, the devisees and legatees of any deceased person who had in his lifetime any interest or lien or encumbrance on the premises involved between themselves. And I wondered if that wasn't why we have this action now. We don't have this in the probate, but it should be one or the other. And it seems to me that the court applied some intestacy laws and recognized some transfers, but not all of them at a minimum. Would you agree?
I agree to a certain extent, because when in the last few days, Mr. Whalen, who is not here today, and I spent some time looking at, there is a discrepancy in the findings of fact, conclusions of law as to how the land was split up and compared to the O&E report. And I'll explain that right quick. And what it looks like is parcel 2 got divided into parcel 1 and parcel 2, where there really should have been 6 parcels to make it more clear. So we agree with how the court divided it. Is what we agree with. But getting back to your question, I think you're right. What the judge tried to do was establish in the judgment that the estate became the owner of the property. And that's what the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and judgment did. So the court found that the estate was the owner at the time of the death. Now, the owner's and encumbrance report didn't do that, because that's not what showed up on the record. But the O&E report did acknowledge that those estates had not been probated yet, and that I believe she testified at the trial. She did testify at the trial. Ms. Rake testified that once the probates are completed, that could change the ownership, which means the O&E report could be changed also.
It's significant, though, because if whatever is decided in this case vis-a-vis the ownership of these parcels, if that's appealed, if that's not appealed, but once it's final, that would seem like it would probably have preclusive effect in any other proceeding that was undertaken to determine ownership. Couldn't we litigate that, it doesn't seem like?
That's an interesting question that I hadn't thought about. But I guess when this matter was originally filed, we realized that these estates still had to be probated. They still had to be probated to find out where this land was going to end up and where it was going to go, and then make a determination as to who the heirs are, the living heirs, or whoever they are at that time.
As it relates to the adverse possession claims, the briefs and the circuit court both referred to, for instance, John and Edward. I suppose those are the only two because those are the ones, those are the siblings that stay, but it refers to them as co-tenants. Are they co-tenants? We've proceeded along this premise that they're co-tenants because of the interest that we believe devolved to them upon the death of their father in 1969. But those are unrecognized interests at this point, at least in a formal record ownership context. Are they truly co-tenants? Is that premise sound?
I guess I believe it is. I believe they are tenants in common. I believe that was a testimony of Christine Rake.
But as a legal matter, is that a sound premise?
I guess in my opinion, it is.
Okay.
In my opinion, it is. I want to explain why we have a discrepancy as to why adverse possession would not apply in this case. As I indicated earlier, these people are vested with this interest upon the death, and then there comes a probate, find out who the heirs are, and then their interest passes on to the heirs, whoever is living at that time. But they can't be removed. Their interest in this property cannot be removed simply by a waiver. You can't just, like you can waive a constitutional right, you know, in criminal law, you can waive your right to remain silent. It's not a vested interest, but you can waive it. Interests in real property are different than that. They just can't be waived. You don't give them up. If you don't know about it, it doesn't mean that you lose it. You still got it. So what Ed ended up doing, the first time he realized that he might have an interest in this property, is he was on this property his entire life, I think except for 2 years he was in the military service. But he was on this property his entire life. He thought his brother might have been the owner, but the first time he found out that he realized that he had an interest is that he tried to put some of this land into a government program. That's what he did, and I believe that was 2017, I believe, was the year that he tried to put it into a government program, and he was told, well, you can't do that because it's not your property.
How do you respond to your opposing counsel's argument that it was clear error for the court to find that he didn't have knowledge of an interest, given if a lawyer sent all of the siblings this correspondence asking them to convey their interest to John back in the 80s? What is your response to that?
I don't know that he necessarily would have had a knowledge. I think that he would have had to had some sort of better understanding. Ed didn't have a lawyer representing him at that time. Obviously, he knew what his brother was trying to do, the impact on it. I don't know that he necessarily knew what the impact was that he was trying to do. But what I think the subsequent acts, or the actions, the information that he received when he tried to put this property into a government program, made what we might think should have been clear at that time, clear back in 2017 when he said, you know, I think something's going on here. I might have an interest in this property. So, but he'd been on this property for years. He testified that he paid taxes on this property. He paid rent to his brother. I think he even paid rent to the trust for a while also. So he had, this property had been, you know, his, or he had been on it for quite a period of time, believing that his brother was the owner, or the trust was the owner of the property.
If he was paying taxes on it, that would seem to suggest he knew he had some ownership interest in it, as opposed to just being a tenant.
I understand it might suggest that, but that was in the latter years. That was in the latter years. So the question is, on latches, did he take an immediate action to do something about it? I still think he took an immediate action. But I would still argue that that doesn't even apply in this case, because he still doesn't lose his right in the property simply because they've made an argument because of adverse possession. Our position is that doesn't matter because it doesn't apply because he still had his interest in this property and he'd never deeded it away to anybody else.
Would you address the application 15315?
The intestacy?
Yes.
To the extent... Well,
no, no, the adverse possession. Adverse 10 years paid the taxes, adverse possession theory.
Claim of color, title, good faith, 10 years possession, paid the taxes.
Whether or not that amounts to adverse possession?
Yes. That's the question.
Those are the elements of adverse possession. And I guess my response is if I said he did some of those things and that they obtained it adversely, I would still come back and say it simply doesn't apply in this case. I mean, that's our position, is adverse possession does not apply when you're a co-tenant or you hold property as tenants in common, because you simply can't lose it because you don't know that it exists. Even if they were to meet the elements of adverse possession. With regard to ouster, the only way, our position is the only way he can be dispossessed or lose an interest in this property is if there is an ouster. And that's our position. If Ed was going to lose his interest in this property, there had to be an ouster. Their own people, the appellants in this case, testified that there was not an ouster in this case.
Those would be legal conclusions, though, don't you think? I mean, I understand that typically the testimony is something that's reviewed deferentially. If there's a finding on it, I don't know that there was a finding on that. But, I mean, isn't that really a legal question?
You know, Justice Salter, I guess it could be, but the point that was made in the appellant's brief is that's the point they made in the appellant's brief. Our position is, well, if that was their concern, they could have objected to that at the time of trial, which they didn't do. Those two individuals could have said, what's an ouster? They didn't do that. The other thing is their attorney could have cross-examined them to ask, do you even understand what an ouster is? So the implication to us is they fully understood what an ouster was or had some sort of an idea that that was an ejectment of Ed from this property, which didn't occur. The facts just do not support an ouster. If there was an ouster, he was there for a very long time. He was never removed from this property. He stayed there for a very long time, constructive or otherwise. The facts just do not support an ouster in this particular case. I briefly went into the division of property, but I want to just make sure that our position is clear. We think that there may be some confusion between the judgment, the findings of fact, and the O&E report. The O&E report does not list the estate as a property owner in this particular case. That is what the judge determined, using the laws of intestacy and based upon the facts of this case. That's what he put in his judgment in this particular case. The error comes when Parcel 2 shows that Joe Monin owns a certain piece of property and the trust owns a certain piece of property. And the judge broke that up, is what he did, and made that Parcel 2. This is the limit. We don't think he did anything wrong, but the confusion comes when if he'd have separated those out and created another parcel for Joe, another parcel for John, then we wouldn't have that confusion. So it's actually consistent with the O&E report, but the O&E report lists 5 parcels, as does the judgment and the findings of fact and conclusions of law. They list 5 parcels. But that's where the confusion comes in. So our position is the judge didn't make a mistake. It's correct. It might be more confusing. And if this court were to affirm, if they find that there is a mistake the way this was parceled out, then the judgment can be amended.
So Edward's trying to quiet title, not in himself, and there's a reference in the complaint that suggests that, but it doesn't seem like that's actually the case. He's trying to quiet title in the estate, in the heirs, but not himself. He's not claiming I own it all.
He's not claiming he owns it all. His goal was to find out if he had an interest in this property. And the only way we could figure out if he had an interest in this property was first to get this O&E report, because we had to know who the presumed title owners were at that particular time. So before anything else was done on this case, the O&E report was obtained. And that gave us a starting point. Well, the first thing you notice is Joe Monin has passed away. So then the next thing we find out, these estates had obviously never been probated. So the next thing we had to do is get somebody to do the probates. Tim Whalen is doing the probates. Then they intervened in this action for the obvious purpose of basically protecting the estate's interest in this matter is what they ended up doing.
What do we do, if anything, with the idea that and the suggestion that was discussed with Mr. Parsons that John may have been in a good position at any point along the way to seek to consolidate his own ownership in terms of the record of title, that is?
I'm not sure I'm following you, Justice.
Was John in a better position than Ed? Does that to sort of clear up whatever inconsistencies or inaccuracies might exist, and does that figure into the equities as we look at latches?
I think when you look at this, it might appear that he was in a better position, but that doesn't put him in a position where he owns a property that he claims he owns.
No, I was just talking about latches.
Well, with regard to latches, our position, and I'm just going to keep hammering on it, is that latches isn't even going to apply in this particular case for the reasons I previously stated. Because this is a vested interest in property in these individuals is what it is. It's not a right that he can waive or give up other than if you deed the property away.
Your time's up, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Parsons, you may proceed with the rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. John and Anna got this farm in 1969, and they're the ones who stayed there for the rest of their lives. Edward was allowed to live in the house and was paid as a hired man, and then later was allowed to rent the property. All the other children left after they graduated from high school. John and Anna improved this farm over the years. They paid for everything, as both Edward and Gabriel testified, paid all the bills, including the taxes. Edward's testimony was all over the place, and he contradicted himself almost every page of the transcript. I didn't know I owned the property. I did know I owned the property. But the undisputed testimony was asked of Edward by his own lawyer, "So at some point in time, did you think you had an interest in the land?" Edward, "Yes." "Okay, when did you think you had an interest in the land, that you might be an owner of some sort of interest?" "Well, back in the 1980s. We all got together, and we were all going to sign it over to John until two of the siblings said they wanted their share, and then that all broke up." That's Edward. Leonard Andera, if he were alive to testify, would have told the court all about that.
So Mr. Schreiber, excuse me, limited time here, is arguing that even if that is the case, if he knew, you still have to have some other legal vehicle for him to lose his actual property right. What's your response?
There are two, latches and adverse possession.
And his claim is that the latches itself is not enough because there is still a vested interest in this regardless. Do you disagree with that?
Yes, I entirely disagree with that. And there are many, many cases where this court's addressed latches among co-tenants, particularly in the early part of last century, and has applied it, and including the Qualley case I mentioned earlier. What we had here, so 40 years go by, 50 years, and one of Joseph and Anna's grandchildren does some digging around after everyone is dead, except for her Uncle Edward and Teresa and her mother, who was not able to testify, Mary Magdalene Koch Vince. And she starts digging around legal records, and she says, "Well, maybe this is Joseph is on this deed that I found, Anna's on this deed." And so she brings this action. She opens probates for someone who died 50 years ago. She opens a probate for Anna, who died 30 years earlier. And then brings old Uncle Edward to a different lawyer and says, "Now you go quiet title." And that's the testimony in this case. Latches is intended to prevent this type of legal archaeology. In the meantime, this is a working farm. It's not a huge chunk of property. This is a working farm. In the meantime, it's been deeded by Anna, her, all of her interest to John, and then John has put it in this trust. They waited for all that to happen. Title has passed. And then when we try to present any evidence about taxes, everyone's dead. No one can testify. Although Gabriel and Edward both admitted John paid for everything.
There is a finding that I believe that even after he got, well, after 1990 and up until, which is the day of Anna's deed, as you know, I think there's a finding that John paid the taxes until 2003. So that would be a substantial period of time, even after the deed.
Correct. And after that, the only court's finding is that it's unclear who paid the taxes because Edward testified he paid the taxes. Now, why would you pay the taxes on land you don't own? Why would you put land you don't own into a government program?
But Gabriel said it looks like it was refunded shortly thereafter for at least the period of time that he looked at.
Okay. Yes, that's correct. And that was your question earlier, Justice Devaney. Yes, that's right. So that's why you just can't go back. And we've cited cases from other states where, and this court as well, where you just don't go back and slice up a working farm among all the lineal descendants after someone has run it, took the risk for 50 years, got the farm through the farm crisis and the next farm crisis, and then now, whoa, we might be something for us in here. Let's try to get it all this time later.
Counsel, if your argument on latches and adverse possession does not prevail, where should potential fractional interest be litigated, in the probates or in the quiet title action?
I think it would make more sense to do it upon reflection in the statute you read, Justice Salter, to do it in this case. But there's not a, I mean, rather than do it twice, I guess, but there's not, it's going to be hard to do.
Do you agree with the idea that one would have preclusive effect over the other if it became a final judgment and one court with competent or with jurisdiction determined ownership claims? It seems like they couldn't be litigated in a parallel proceeding.
I guess it sounds like res judicata. They're not the same parties exactly.
I'm putting you on the spot, but it seems like that.
Yeah. I hope this court doesn't do that, though, because this case ought to be decided and title quieted on latches and adverse possession because there was an ouster under the law. We ask you reverse, Your Honor. Your Honors.
That will conclude the arguments on this case. We'll be in recess until 10:30 this morning.